Julie Keister is up next. She's going to take us away from the vegetation towards another part of the food web. She's an associate professor at UW School of Oceanography, studying zooplankton ecology for over 20 years, focusing on climate-driven environmental change and how it affects zooplankton abundance, distribution, and species composition, and then the implications that has for salmon and other fisheries. She's been contributing to the Salish Sea Marine Survival Project since it started in 2011, and to the Washington OA Center since 2014. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you. Adjustment. Pause for adjustment. Okay. Is this gonna? Sorry. Okay. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for the invitation to speak here. This is an incredible symposium, and this is going to be a really fun day. So yeah, I focus on zooplankton, and a lot of my research recently has been in Puget Sound. So today I'm going to give you a little bit about what we know about South Puget Sound zooplankton, its variability, and how it fits into the broader picture of Puget Sound in general. So starting with who our zooplankton are, we have an amazingly diverse composition of zooplankton species in Puget Sound. It mimics the coastal ocean and the North Pacific, as well as having some different taxa specific to Puget Sound estuaries. We have over 30 species of copepods alone. These are the tiny crustaceans that are 1 to about 3 millimeters that are typically the most abundant zooplankton in the global oceans everywhere, and is true here in Puget Sound as well. There's about 5 or 7 of them that dominate in Puget Sound at any time, but we get up to this many, which makes them really interesting to study as indicators. We have several species of krill. These are euphausids. Our dominant one is Euphausia pacifica, pictured here. We have lots and lots of decapods, shrimp and crab, that put larvae into the water column and are zooplankton for a part of their life cycle. We've got at least 4 species of amphipods. We've got pteropods that are great indicators of ocean acidification. We have this huge assembly of jellyfish, most of which are tiny little things, but beautiful under the microscope. Some of which are the gigantic ones that you see, like cyania, that get a meter in diameter or more. And then chelicnaths, which are arrow worms, lots of bivalves, gastropods, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on, and it's so diverse, it makes it so interesting to study, especially as their role in environmental variability and as indicators of those changes. So why study them? I just said why I study them, in this sense anyway. A lot of my research focuses on how to look at zooplankton species composition, abundances, and biomass, and how those change in relation to the environment. This has been recognized globally as a very important indicator and issue. In 2008, this paper came out called In Hot Water, Zooplankton and Climate Change, in which zooplankton were called beacons of climate change. They were called this because they can often be a leading indicator of environmental signals that individually are relatively subtle, but together create a change in the environment that cascades up through lower trophic levels and through the zooplankton. In 2018, there was a suite of international scientists that recommended zooplankton monitoring as a way to contribute to understanding global changes in biodiversity, saying zooplankton are sensitive indicators, as well as a whole lot more in that paper. And then just very recently, a report to the Puget Sound Partnership recommended a new zooplankton index as an indicator of ecosystems and communities. So there's this building recognition that zooplankton are great indicators of climate variability and that they can be developed for use in management and fisheries practices. Why else do we study zooplankton? Though we all really know, I think, they are very important in food webs. And so a lot of the interest in this region is in how zooplankton are links in the food webs leading to fish that we love, forage fish, salmon, and all the things that feed on them, seabirds, and even our poor orcas at the moment. So this trophic link is also an incredibly important part of my research, understanding the variability in zooplankton and how that leads to changes in fisheries and upper trophic levels. Just as an example of how important zooplankton can be, this is a plot of the proportions of different taxa in the composition of juvenile Chinook diets coming from your local river, the Nisqually. I didn't give you the names of every single little color, but I did point out that the crab larvae make up a huge component of these juvenile Chinook diets in midsummer, from early June to late July. Up to 70% of their guts, on average, can be filled with these crab larvae. So they're incredibly important. They vary. And there's also other important zooplankton that come into the picture, some euphausids, some amphipods, and a box here I called other, which was like things like cladocerans and larvaceans and little things. But this is just one example of how the variability in zooplankton can very clearly move through the ecosystem to species that we care a lot about here. I'm just going to take a pause in my thought process about why we're studying them to challenge something I just said myself, which is that they are an important link in marine food webs. Because while it's true that a lot of zooplankton are herbivorous grazers grazing on phytoplankton and therefore are the next step up from phytoplankton, it's not that simple. So this, for instance, is a photo of one of my favorite copepods, Euchita, which is a predatory copepod feeding on another copepod. So this is clearly not one trophic link. This is copepods eating copepods. But it gets more complicated. This is a siphonophore. You may barely be able to see its outline. It's eaten one of those Euchita. So the jellyfish are feeding on these big copepods. And here's an arrow worm, has also eaten this poor Euchita. You're getting the impression maybe that Euchita are the best copepod food, but all copepods get eaten like this. But now, even more complicated, here's a different copepod eating a ketognath. So there are multiple links in this trophic web that we call zooplankton. It's not one trophic step from phytoplankton to fish. It's a very complex multi-trophic level system itself. Okay. Thanks, that was my end of my geekiness. And let's get back to the big pictures. What we want to know is what causes ecosystem and fisheries variability, and what are good indicators of those changes. So when we think about the chain of anthropogenic changes and large-scale climate variability, downscaling to what we observe locally in our physics and chemistry, how do those affect the lower trophic levels? And then how do those in turn affect ecosystems and fisheries? So historically, there's been very little zooplankton data from Puget Sound that would help us address this type of question. But recently, in 2014, the Puget Sound Zooplankton Monitoring Program began as part of the Salish Sea Marine Survival Project, which as a huge project was designed to examine the reasons why juvenile salmon variability and growth and survival have been so poor in Puget Sound in the last several decades. This is a large program with lots of collaborators, many of whom are in this room. It involves many tribes, agencies, and the University of Washington, Department of Ecology, Fish and Wildlife, NOAA, the Lummi Quiot Group, Tulalip Tribe, King County does several stations in Central Basin, and the Nisqually Tribe is the group that samples a couple of locations in South Puget Sound, one of which we sampled only the first 2 years, and the other is the index I'll show you for some of the data today that's off South Hetron Island. So this is the program that's providing us data spatially and temporally. They sample every 2 weeks from spring till early fall, every year since 2014. Some of the groups sample year-round. This is a typo. Almost all of them sample biweekly. Only a couple of them sample monthly. And this has become a really important data set for us to look at variability in zooplankton across the region. Okay, so let's start at looking at zooplankton communities as a whole and how they look in Puget Sound relative, in South Sound relative to Puget Sound. This is an ordination of zooplankton communities. Each dot, for those of you who are not familiar with this technique, each dot represents one zooplankton sample. So what's in a net, the zooplankton species composition in a single net tow. They're color-coded by the basins. San Juan would be down to South Sound. And each dot represents a date in this time series in 2014 as an example. So dots that are very close together represent zooplankton communities that are very similar, and dots that are very far apart represent very different communities. So this is where South Sound fits in this ordination. There's a fairly distinct cluster. And what you can see is that when I overlay this as main basin, they share some similarity in species composition, but there's also a lot of dissimilarity between those two regions, which is kind of surprising given the proximity and the tidal exchange between them. South Sound also overlaps a bit with Whidbey Basin, but not a lot with Hood Canal or Admiralty Inlet, and it's very distinct from the San Juan Islands community. So what we know about these by looking at correlations with these ordinations is that the dominant shift from north to south, the San Juans down into South Sound, is a shift from oceanic taxa to fewer oceanic taxa. So fewer of the species that have oceanic origins in South Sound compared to the San Juans. Well, that also seems kind of obvious, but we didn't know that before. It's interesting. It's implying that the evective processes through Puget Sound are on a short enough time scale, or don't affect the short enough time scales so that these zooplankton communities can diverge. So ocean taxa to fewer ocean taxa. Another important difference, though, is that the further south you get into Puget Sound, the more of those small siphonophores that show up. That's the siphonophores that were eating the copepod in that first one of the first slides. So siphonophores are very important in South Sound as well. Okay, so we can look at these same data in a time series. Now, this is a very busy, complicated plot. So I'm just going to point out a couple of things and then move on to a simpler plot for us to look at. These are color-coded all by individual stations with the basins. If you want to pick out any particular basin, I put South Sound in hot pink, so you should be able to pick that one out, especially if I help you. That's this here. And what you might notice is that on an axis of total zooplankton biomass, South Sound's pretty low. It's not the lowest, but it's pretty low relative to other locations in Puget Sound. What you can also notice is that there's this pretty big interannual variability in Puget Sound as a whole, especially. And Helen referred to the blob years. 2014 was when the blob started to intrude into Puget Sound. For the most part, 2014 temperatures in Puget Sound were kind of normal. But 2015 was off the charts, hottest on record. 2016 was just a little bit cooler, but still definitely warm. And 2017, a little bit cooler again. Some areas were getting back to kind of normal and some areas not. But we have this pattern of the lowest biomass overall in the normal year and increasing biomass in the warmer years. So how does that look for South Sound if we look at it a little bit differently? Again, these are exactly the same data but plotted differently. Now these are cumulative biomass curves from the beginning of sampling in each year, color-coded by year 2014 in blue, 2015 in yellow, 2016 in purple, and 2017 in yellow, and these four different regions coming down from the San Juan Islands through Admiralty Inlet, Central Basin, and South Sound. And if you look at these, one thing you can see right away is that each region is doing something a little bit different with respect to these years. And that's no surprise to us. We all know Puget Sound is a very diverse ecosystem. And this is how we'll start to diagnose some of those differences. Another thing is that this year, 2014, which is in blue, is the lowest, or just about the lowest, in every one of these regions, with the warmer years having higher cumulative biomass. The patterns are a little bit different, and if we just focus on South Sound, we see low 2014, higher 2015 as it warmed, but then off the charts for 2016 and 2017 with no symptom that it's getting back towards 2014 as some of the other regions have. So that's cool. And then I just want to point out again this difference in total biomass where South Sound here 350, Admiralty Inlet 450, and Central Basin 400 total. So South Sound's just a little on the low side, but definitely not as low as the San Juan Islands, which is dominated by those oceanic taxa. Okay, I just want to show a little bit more of these time series. I'm sorry, they're complicated, but just to show some of the taxa that are a little bit different in South Sound. This is the siphonophores that I referred to earlier. They eat a lot of copepods. They're very important in food chains, and they are more dominant in South Sound than they are in the rest of Puget Sound. And this is shown here, South Sound again in hot pink. So you see there's some very, very high biomass of these siphonophores in most of these spring and early summer times. Central Basin has a lot too, but not as many, not nearly as many. And again, there's this really high interannual variability, strong, strong seasonal cycle. But interestingly, as the years have warmed, we've gotten fewer of these. So there's something about perhaps the blob years that helped to keep these populations in check. Now the Noctiluca is a little dinoflagellate that's predatory. It eats other microplankton and tiny zooplankton and sometimes even fish eggs. These guys are basically not present in South Sound compared to the rest of Puget Sound, at least at the locations that we've been sampling. So here's our little pink line, almost zeros. Those who are you looking over here, almost zeros. So this is interesting. So we think of siphonophores as maybe being an indication of a disturbed ecosystem, and we think of Noctiluca as being an indication of a disturbed ecosystem, and yet they're doing totally different things down here in South Sound. These are both very important species in food webs. They both control zooplankton communities, and so these patterns probably have really big implications for the food webs in these regions. Okay, so overall, I think what we're learning about South Sound is that it is a unique composition of zooplankton, although it has similarities with Main Basin and also Whidbey Basin, not surprisingly, but it does have some of its own unique characteristics. It harbors fewest of the oceanic taxa in Puget Sound and more of the siphonophores, fewer of the Noctiluca. There's large interannual variability that shows some links to climate in our very preliminary analyses so far, and we do have funding to take these questions a little bit further about how each of these sub-basins of Puget Sound are responding to environmental variability, so we'll be pursuing that further in the next year or so. We have very poor understanding of the spatial patterning within South Sound. We only have two samples, two stations, one of which we dropped after a couple of years because those two stations happen to look really similar. But we know that every little finger and inlet is probably doing something different. And that's something that's going to be hard to get a grasp on because the level of sampling to make that spatial analysis would be intense. But it is something that we need to consider when we think about these data. So with that, I want to thank my taxonomists and data analysts, and especially all of the sampling partners and funding partners that have helped contribute to this program so far. Thank you.
Question over here?
Okay, so on your introductory slide, when you were discussing zooplankton communities, you didn't mention embryonic rockfish. Do you consider larval rockfish to be an important part of the zooplankton community?
Did you say embryonic dogfish?
Rockfish.
Rockfish, okay, I'm sorry. We get a lot of fish larvae in our zooplankton net tows, and we have learned to ID a few of them, but we are not good at it. We're definitely not experts. I would say that fish larvae in general are very important in this community, and we so far don't have the expertise to say who's who, except for a few forage fish that we've learned. I expect that they are important. I don't know how long they're in the water column, but they certainly would be feeding on these organisms and therefore altering the food web structure themselves, yes.
Hi, thanks for that. That was a great talk. I'm wondering if you can say anything more about Noctiluca. I don't think I got enough of a chance to look maybe at that one slide. But all I notice from Noctiluca is I see it sometimes on the surface of the water, and I'm wondering if you see a lot more of it in South and Central Sound than other places, or any other comments on what you've seen related to Noctiluca.
Are you asking specifically about the surface expressions?
I would love to know about how what I see, which is just the surface expression, compares to what's really going on in the whole water column.
Yes, and we have been talking about doing that direct comparison for years, and now we have the data to do it. I don't know yet whether the surface expressions will correlate very well with what's in the water column. It ought to, except the time scales of the sampling might make that difficult to look at. So for those of you who don't know much about Noctiluca biology, when they're starting to sort of starve and run out of nutrients, they'll float up to the surface and form these massive surface blooms or slicks that are observable from the eyes over Puget Sound flights, for example. And then they are very, very noticeable, and I think that we do see them in South Sound. What my nets are seeing are all of the Noctiluca just under one very small patch of water, but throughout the whole water column when they're healthy and feeding and doing their normal thing. And what would be very interesting to look at is how these patterns that we see just from my spot net tows compare to the surface expressions, and whether we can learn something about the sampling biases, perhaps, or the life cycle from that comparison. But we haven't done that yet.
Hi. Given the closure of Dungeness crab in the South Sound, I'm wondering if you've seen any changes in cancer larvae in your samples.
Let me see if I have a slide on that. Copepods, crabs. We only have 4 years of data, so I'm not going to be able to address that, I think, on the sense of the time scales that we're talking about. And this particular slide is not broken down to Dungeness or even to Cancridae. We have those data, so we could look at them. But what we can see is that at least there is large interannual variability in the crab larvae in South Sound. And this is showing that very recently there have been much higher numbers of crab larvae than there have been in the first couple of years of the program, but that's only a few years. And overall, these numbers are quite low compared to where, like Admiralty Inlet's an order of magnitude higher than South Sound abundances. So numbers are low. I would have to parse this out for Dungeness specifically to be able to answer that question. And we do have those data. Could do that.
One last question. Yeah. One thing that we're interested in a little bit is, and you pointed it out, with salmon diets and the zooplankton, were you seeing any trends as far as proximity to eelgrass beds or kelp beds in the differences in communities of zooplankton that you were finding, or are you planning to investigate those differences at all?
We don't have enough sampling sites in eelgrass beds to address that at all. Yeah, that would have to be a separate program, or I don't know if somebody already has data on that. I think Jeff Cordell at UW maybe has done some studies in and out of eelgrass beds, but I don't know. And my data can't address that question, I'm afraid.
All right, just